Stories, Threads, and Magic from the Life of Dennis C. Merritt, Part 3. Professional Dancer, 1970s, Cambridge. Back in the 1970s, in Cambridge, Mass., a recent Harvard MBA graduate had an idea for a business. Serious dance lessons for non-serious dancers. Instructors that taught jazz and ballet dancing in studios with wood floors and mirrors and bars. But for ordinary people. He called it the Joy of Movement Center, with a number of studio locations throughout the city. It was a huge success. All sorts of people signed up to learn the sort of dance serious dancers did, including my wife and I. We thought we were pretty good dancers, what knowing how to do the mashed potatoes and all, and were fairly athletic 20-year-olds at the time, so we signed up for intermediate jazz, because, clearly, we were past beginner. Huge mistake. There were 5, 6, 7, 8s coming at us faster than we could process, and isolations and moves and complex choreography. We quickly developed a lot of respect for serious dancers. Our instructor had a professional dance troupe, Becky Arnold's Dancing Machine, and she'd just lost one of her male dancers. Male dancers were hard to find, and she needed a replacement for one number in her show, and she thought I showed some promise. So she asked me to be in her show. Well, what a trip. Of course I said yes. She worked with me on the moves and the choreography, but I had a hard time remembering the sequences, and even when I did, well, I got the moves, but probably not with the pizzazz I should have had. Then came the night of our performance at the Berklee Performance Center in Boston. It was lightly attended, but still, there was an audience. I made it through all the moves, so no great embarrassment, but that's probably all I can say. Becky came up to me after the show and gave me $5, my share of the gate, and told me I wouldn't be needed anymore. But still, that makes me a professional dancer, right? Epilogue. We remained friends with Becky and her husband and took a number of other courses with other instructors and enjoyed them all. But then, sigh, people, there were arguments between the young business guy who started it and the instructors, and battles over the money, and the whole thing just fell apart. Hippies at Work, 1970s, Draper Labs. Joan Livingston, a fellow Shelburne Falls writer, also on Substack, recently wrote about her dishwashing experience in college and how a dean wanted to get her fired because of her hippie look. I had a similar experience, and it's also a strand that connects two stories in this book, Bullies and Adventure, although it wasn't a part of either of them. It's hard to say I was a real hippie back in the day, although I did certainly go for the hippie look. I had long hair, wore jeans to work, lived in a big old house full of people, like Mel, and was against the war, Vietnam, and smoked some dope. On the other hand, the big old house was in Winchester, Mass., a Boston suburb notorious for old money, and I was working for an aerospace company, most of which work was military. The Star Occultation Project I worked on was a non-military project, and after I was made chief scientist and programmer, in the Bullies story, I went on to do what might have been my best work at the lab. However, my boss's boss didn't like a long-haired hippie wandering around his clean-cut group. The country might have been more divided then than it is now. The anti-war movement, civil rights, the environment, and then feminism were tearing the country apart. And you could tell which side of the divide one was on by the length of one's hair. My boss's boss made his displeasure clear and made sure I got a zero raise. Do you see about the times? Both Joan in her story and me in mine were being penalized at work because of the side of the political-cultural divide we chose. A cautionary tale. Well, it all worked out fine for me, maybe something about karma balancing things out. The story of me in the first interactive adventure game, Adventure, later, tells of my getting the maximum raise when in fact I'd spent all of my time on the lab computer playing games. Apollo 11, 1969, Cambridge. 1969, the country was split between conservatives and liberals, maybe even more so than it is today. The Vietnam War was huge in our lives, and many college kids were actively protesting against it. MIT was no exception. Here are the players and events involved in this story. Doc Draper. Doc Draper was a legend at MIT. He drove a little sports car and always parked it facing out. The story goes that that was a habit he got when he was running bootleg liquor to fund his MIT education. He made a major contribution to World War II with the invention of an inertial gun platform. Because of the rolling of a ship in the sea, it was hard to aim a ship's anti-aircraft guns that were attached to the deck. Draper's inertial platform used gyroscopes to provide a stable base for those guns, letting the ship roll beneath it. The story goes that when they first tried them, he was on the ship, and when some Japanese Zeros attacked the ships, the gunners fled for safety. Draper ran out to take their place, and the horrified admiral had to hold him back. The platforms made a huge difference in our ability to defend against those suicide planes. MIT Instrumentation Lab. Doc Draper started the lab based on his inertial guidance technology, which was now used in guidance systems for missiles. It's basically a gyroscope attached to something that detects motion. The lab was funded with government defense contracts and provided work for MIT students and faculty. Apollo. The lab got the contract for the guidance system work for Apollo. The protests. Students protested the lab, said there was no way a peaceful university should be funded with military contracts. Lots of bad PR for the lab and MIT. The suits. As Draper had gotten older, the running of the lab wound up in the hands of more serious business types, wearing suits among the engineering techies. They were very much aware of the bad PR of the military contracts and spent money publicizing the lab's work on Apollo and a few other minor peaceful projects. They worked hard at downplaying the military contracts. Me. I worked at the lab. My MIT friends got me a job there, working on the backup Apollo navigation system, an optical sextant. Which brings me to the day Apollo 11 came back to Earth. It was probably Draper's idea to have a large truck full of champagne show up. We started drinking and celebrating and drinking and celebrating. The news cameras showed up in a large room with tables. The suits were there. We were there. The news was there. The cameras were rolling. And Draper was there. Draper, drunk, climbed up on a table. The cameras were rolling and the suits were afraid. He said, "When I started this lab, we built war machines. And we still build war machines, and I'm damn proud of it." Epilogue. The MIT Instrumentation Lab divested itself from MIT and changed its name to Draper Lab. The divestment agreement was long and complex, and basically said that all of the connections between MIT and the lab would still be there, except at the very top, it would be a separate entity, so it could pursue military contracts without giving the school a bad name. Diana and Rubik's Cube, 1984, Winchester. I had a Rubik's Cube that was solved. And Diana, at the age of 4 or 5, said she could solve the puzzle. I told her it was hard. She said she could handle it. So I just made one rotation, and she put it back. Then I did 2, no problem, and 3, no problem. She was full of confidence and wanted to try a harder one. So we did four. And she made a false move, and it just started getting more and more scrambled. She studied the disarrayed cube, realized I wanted it back the way it was, realized she couldn't do it, assessed the situation, and said, "Dad, we're going to have to peel the colored stickers off and put them back on to get it right again." Brilliant! I showed her we could do just that by physically taking the cube apart and putting it back correctly. Small Town Politics, 1970s, Winchester. Winchester had a representative town meeting. That meant the members of the town meeting were all individuals elected by the people in their neighborhoods. The town meeting was the legislative branch for the town and acted just like Congress at the national level or any other legislative body. Members had lots to read and study, and there were frequent meetings to debate the issues and then vote on resolutions. The most important ones had to do with the budget. A board of selectmen acted as the executive branch of the town, enacting the town laws. This meant the town was a perfect microcosm for understanding how branches of government work in our political system. They were having trouble filling all the seats in the town meeting, and my neighbor, who had been our neighborhood representative, urged me to run. So I did, and my campaign slogan was, "If nobody else wants it, I'll do it." Good enough? I won. It was an education, and I highly recommend anyone get involved in politics at a local level. Here are a few observations from the 1970s, which I believe are relevant today. Yes, no. All a legislative body can do is answer yes, no questions. That's what a vote is. This was actually quite frustrating as we worked over the town budget. There was no ability to make trade-off decisions. So we could make individual yes, no votes on individual budget items, but not have any big picture input. That's why it's important to have committees that make these sort of decisions. In this case, it was the town finance committee that came up with a recommendation for a budget and all the trade-offs that entailed. Experience counts. A regular at town meeting was our representative to the state legislature. He was always there pointing out what he had done for the town lately. For example, there was an old bridge over abandoned railroad tracks in town that badly needed repairs. Our state rep knew of an obscure state law that provided funds for situations regarding abandoned railroad tracks. So he was able to get state funding to repair the bridge so the town didn't have to pay for it. You can see how it goes. He saves the town some money. He could do that because he'd been in state government long enough to know all these bits and pieces. The town politicos appreciates that and then work for his re-election. The general electorate is really none the wiser to any of this. All they see is lots of lawn signs and ads to elect that guy. But they're all there because the locals are working for him, and they're doing that because he is working for them. On the state level at that time, Ted Kennedy was the Massachusetts senator. He was barely able to talk straight sentences through his alcoholism, probably guilty of manslaughter, and yet got reelected year after year. Why? I suspect it's the same reason. That with his seniority, he's better able to bring federal government into the state. And those in the state that directly benefit turned out each election cycle to keep him in office. Campaign expenses. The job of town selectmen is a thankless one. These people are up late hours dealing with all sorts of issues like this restaurant's liquor license, the budget, parking space, etc. Lots of boring reading, lots of irritating people, and no salary, strictly volunteer. The year I was involved in town politics, the selectmen vying for re-election were spending around $10,000 each on their campaigns. This was in the 1970s. $10,000 for a chance to do a real pain-in-the-ass job with no pay. Why? Strangely, all the selectmen were also in the Chamber of Commerce. Local business people. And once they got in, do you know what the top priority of town government was? Revitalizing the downtown Winchester Business District. Town funds went into fancy lights, brick sidewalks, commercial courtyards, etc., etc. There were lots of families in town. Most people I know really wished we had a town swimming pool and rec center, but we got bricks downtown instead. Someone who wants a pool isn't going to spend $10,000 of their own money to get elected to a position that will let them help make that happen. So you watch that happen in Winchester and suddenly understand the how and why of millions spent on national campaigns. Fighting for your local issue. The people working on the town government issues had little use for those with personal complaints. There are always trade-offs, like where the low-income housing should go, or if a bike path should be built, or a dead-end street connected. When the residents on the dead-end street came out and started pitching their case to the town meeting, well, we're all working at this stuff, and they don't do anything for the town except protest when it's their little bit of turf. Absolutely no sympathy. Moral. If you want to get something done in the town, you have to be involved in more issues than just your own pet project. Politics is scratching each other's backs. The more backs you scratch, the better chance you have of getting your own scratched. Cycling Voice, 1970s, Concord. There's a sign in a friend's home which said, "You're just jealous the voices don't speak to you." Once, nearly 50 years ago, I had a debate with a voice in my head that demanded to be heard. I had gotten into bike racing in the mid-1970s and would often be out training on the rural roads not far outside of Boston. Sometimes I would be riding with others and sometimes alone. I had a bit of an attitude about these training rides, in that I believed I had a right to ride on the smooth pavement of the road and not on the gravelly 3 feet or so along the edge. There were two reasons for this. One was the speed and focus. Someone on a racing bike is going reasonably fast and focused on their workout. These weren't pleasure rides looking at the scenery, although it was always pleasant on the outskirts of Boston. The other was the tires. I don't know how they're made today, but back then you raced on what were called sew-up tires. They were lightweight and could take a lot of pressure, which also meant they were prone to getting flat. It wasn't a good idea to ride that sort of tire on a gravelly bit of road. As I was riding, I would hear cars coming up behind me, but I always held my line, thinking I had as much right to the road as they did, and they could pass when it was clear. I never looked back at the car, and I just kept my head down and pedaled. Always. Then one day, riding along somewhere out in Concord, Mass., I heard a car coming up behind, and a voice in my head said, "Move over." I was surprised, never having experienced anything like that before. It was practically audible. Having no idea what that was, I thought back, "No, I hold my line." The voice repeated, "Move over." Again, I said, "No, I'm not riding in the gravel." More insistent, a third time, it said, "Move over." So I moved over and rode in the gravel. As the car came by, I glanced left and saw it giving me a safe, wide berth. I was wondering what that was all about and started to pull back into the road and was almost hit by the extra wide trailer the car was towing. Craig's Go Lesson, 1970s, San Francisco. This is a story of a rather humbling Go lesson a friend of mine received from a visiting Japanese professional. While it's about a game of Go, that's not really what it's about. But still, you need to know a little about Go to understand the story. Go is primarily an Asian game, with the best players being from China, Korea, or Japan. It's played on a 19x19 grid, with the players placing white and black stones on the intersections of the lines. The idea is to surround territory on the board with your stones, where each intersection of the grid is worth 1 point. It's also possible to surround and capture the opponent's stones. Whoever has the most territory at the end of the game wins. Play involves each player pushing boundaries in different parts of the board, grabbing territory here, threatening each other's stones there, and in the process forming groups of stones weaving in and out of around each other on the board. The game is over when there are no more points to be gained. The players then look at the chaotic pattern of interlocking groups of stones and begin a tedious task of counting up the score. In a close game, amateurs often don't know who won until that final counting. On the other hand, sometimes it's easy to tell who won, as a stronger player might score a massive victory by surrounding not just territory, but the stones of the other player was using for walls as well. The interaction between the groups of stones is so complex, the weaker player might simply not have seen it coming. How difficult is it to count the score? It's only been recently, with the latest AI advances, that a computer could even tell who was winning a game. I used to play Go at the Massachusetts Go Club in Boston, and had a friend, Craig, who was an intermediate sort of amateur, just like myself. He went on a trip to San Francisco once, where at the time there was a visiting Japanese Go professional. Craig signed up for a lesson. The nice thing about Go is it's easy to handicap, so players of different strengths can have balanced games. The weaker player can have from 2 to 9 stones strategically placed on the board at the beginning of the game. The pro gave Craig the maximum 9-stone handicap, and they proceeded to play. The pro was quiet during the game. At the end, it turned out Craig lost by 10 points. He was feeling pretty good about himself, to have only lost by 10 points to a Japanese professional player. In our local club, it wasn't uncommon for Craig or myself to lose by 50 or more points to the stronger players, who enjoyed demolishing their opponents. So we started fishing for compliments. The pro didn't say much. Craig, who could be a bit arrogant, kept insisting, wanting to know if that wasn't pretty good for him to stay within 10 points of the pro, even at a 9-stone handicap. Finally, the pro relented. He explained, "For me to have won by more than 10 points would have been rude. For me to have won by less than 10 points would not have indicated my true strength." Craig suddenly realized that he was destined to lose by exactly 10 points before a single stone was placed on the board. The pro had totally controlled the board without Craig knowing it, so that his victory would be by not 9, not 11, but precisely 10 points. The pro then swept all the stones off the board, reconstructed the game from memory, picked a few key points in the game where he ran down alternate scenarios Craig might have played, and that was the lesson. Cycling with John Alice, 1970s, Boston. I started racing bicycles in the mid-1970s, a time when the sport was really small and most of the racers were runners with bad knees. I like to brag that I was a Category 1 rider, which I was, except that back then that was the only category. You simply paid your dues and you were a licensed bike racer. I was extremely lucky to have lived in the Boston area when John Alice was one of the top riders in the country. He was on our Olympic teams and national champion a few times, and a super nice guy, and an evangelist for the sport. He trained twice a day on a 40-mile loop through the hills west of Boston. Anyone who wanted to ride with him could, so there were usually about 20 of us just tagging on. He'd ride hard up the hills, but then easy on the downsides so people could catch up before the next hill. One year, the state championship was a 110-mile race on a 10-mile loop with big climbs on it. After a couple of laps, I just thought it was going too slow, so I went off the front. The way bike racing works is there's a lot of drafting. The peloton, main group of riders, stays together because it's easier to ride as a group, with riders taking turns breaking the wind. Going off the front, you lose that advantage. Nobody respected me. By that I mean, no one came with me to try to make a breakaway of a small group of writers. Except, after not too long, John Alice did. He broke away from the peloton, caught up to me, and as he passed me said, "Let's go." What a thrill, me and John Alice, off the front. Well, that scared a lot of people, and some other riders caught up to us, and it was a fast and strong break. It lost me after about 70 miles, but still, I finished around 10th, and what a thrill to have created the winning break with John Alice. In New England at the time, there were a number of races that drew the best riders from around the country with their prizes. Somerville, New Jersey, Fitchburg, Mass., and Allentown, Pennsylvania. Riders today are impressed that I rode those races, which are now just for the elite riders. But as I said, back then, anyone could play. The current national champion was a Californian named John Howard. He came to race in Fitchburg, and I was there. I marked him. I waited for his move. I wanted to be there when he went. Boom, he exploded from the peloton, and I was right on his wheel. It was me and John Howard off the front. He let out and then moved over to see who was with him and let them take the lead. I charged past, ready to work with him. He looked at me, sat up in his saddle, and with a look of complete disdain, stopped pedaling. He let the pack catch up and waited until he could get someone better to ride with him. What a blow. He did go off again and got some other better-known riders and won the race. I finished 10th or so and won a tire. Still, what an asshole. Then there was the big 170-mile race in Canada with a Volkswagen microbus as first prize. Everyone who was anyone from Boston went up there, along with all the big names from across the country. John Howard was there. John Alice was there. John Howard had the better sprint of the two and was more arrogant. John Alice was all about riding hard over the distance, but if anyone stayed with him to the end, he would lose the sprint to the finish. Anyway, it was, as I said, a 170-mile race, and 20 miles into the race, John Alice went off the front by himself. Everyone else was pacing themselves. They knew that a lone rider couldn't stay out in front of a peloton made up of the best riders in the country for 150 miles, so they let him go. And the miles passed, and they didn't see him. Somewhere around the 120-mile mark, John Howard got worried and decided to go after him. He chased and chased, but never caught him. John Alice drove home in the Volkswagen microbus. Me, I had stayed home, and it was a strange lesson. Everyone better than me had gone to that race, meaning I was the best rider left in Boston. At the weekly race, I went off the front, and one guy went with me, except he just stayed on my wheel and didn't help break the wind at all. The race was many laps around a circuit, and we lapped the pack. I went off the front again, this time by myself. I won easily. It was really boring. Epilogue. Well, the sport started to grow. I raced for 3 years, getting stronger and faster each year, but the sport was growing faster than I was. Despite getting stronger, each year I finished further and further back. It was kind of discouraging, so I quit as the sport left me behind. But what fun to have been there part of it for those years. Blackjack and Roulette, 1985 to 2018, various casinos. In the 1980s, my work brought me to conferences held in places with casinos, where I enjoyed the opportunity to try my hand at the games of chance. Being of a scientific mind, I knew the odds were in favor of the house, and, with that attitude, I lose fast and regularly. On one trip, I decided to try to beat the odds by adjusting my karma. My plan was to mix my gambling fortunes with others. Here was the idea. If I was gambling with others' money, mixed with mine, then it wouldn't be just my fate on the line. It would be theirs as well. Further, while winning or losing wasn't actually that important to me, If I was gambling with others' money, I'd be much more invested, being the people-pleaser sort of person, in winning. I went to my friends at work who weren't going to the conference and told them if they invested in the experiment, I would either double their money in Las Vegas or lose it all. My right pocket was my gambling pocket. I put $100 of my money in it, and anyone else could add as they saw fit. Whatever percentage of the money was originally theirs, that percentage of the right pocket would be theirs at the end. Only a few people saw fit to invest, but they were people I felt had good luck and a good sense of humor. The conference went for 4 days. I nursed $25 a night for every night I was there, and as I normally expected, the house odds kept eating away at it. I mostly played the $2 blackjack tables because you could play there the longest before losing your money. By Thursday afternoon, we were getting ready to leave the conference. Our transportation wasn't there yet, and I had maybe an hour to kill. I still had $40 in my right pocket and was thinking my experiment had failed. On the other hand, I had promised to either lose it all or double it. I went back to the blackjack table with a mission. I had a different sense. I felt like a winner as I looked for a table with a dealer who looked like a loser. I started betting $5 because I didn't have much time. I was winning. I upped the bets to $25 and immediately got hands that allowed me to split my cards and double my bets, magnifying my winnings. In a few quick hands, I had made up the losses of the week and doubled the original money. Australia. I repeated the trick in a casino in Australia on another business trip. This time, there was only one night available to visit the casino, but after hearing the story above, a few friends added their money to my gambling pocket. Just as before, I spent most of the night slowly losing the money at blackjack. It was getting late and time to go back to the hotel, so I headed out. As I was leaving, I was aware I had a little bit of gambling money left, and I was walking by a roulette table, and I had promised to lose it all or double it. I put all the remaining money on a single roulette number. It won, paying 35 to 1, which, you guessed it, exactly doubled my original stake. I enjoyed paying off the friends who had invested in me. Aruba. Mary and I got married on August 16, 1991, and went on our honeymoon to Aruba. They have casinos there. We had a plan. We would go to the casino in the downtown area and play blackjack until we'd won $100. If we won that $100, we would take it to the roulette table and put it on number 16. If it won, that would earn us $3,500, paying for the entire honeymoon. So we went downtown and started playing blackjack. It was going according to plan, and we were gradually accumulating winnings. Mary got bored, though, and went to a roulette table and placed a not very big bet on a square of four numbers that included 16. It came up 16. She was thrilled, and she came back with her winnings. I said, "Oh no, you used up our 16. But those winnings helped us get closer to our $100 goal, and after some more time at blackjack, we had made $100. We left the casino and didn't even try to play 16 at the roulette table, thinking we'd already gotten our win from that number. We took a taxi back to our hotel, which wasn't downtown. It also had a small casino in it, but it was empty, and it was dark, though it was open. There was a roulette table with a croupier standing by it. It all had a surreal movie feel to it. A darkened, empty casino, a roulette table, and the two of us with our $100 and our plan. But $100 was worth more back then, and we'd had our 16. But still, should we play it? It was the plan. Or just hold it? We were thrashing, and the croupier waited for us. We decided to keep our $100, and he spun the wheel, though there were no bettors. We watched the ball bounce around, and as the wheel slowed, it popped here, then there, and then, yes, you know where it landed, on 16. A cruise. Around 2018, Nancy and I went on a cruise, and it had a casino. We decided to play blackjack for a while. I had a book that told the optimum plays, so I memorized them, and we headed for a table. Now, understand that these stories describe the majority of my casino gambling experiences, and I don't really know what I'm doing. We were about to get an education. We sat at a blackjack table, and I was making the recommended bets, and we were gradually winning. Then I got a pair of jacks. I was sure the book said that I should split my jacks. It didn't, but I did. You don't have to know what that is, just that splitting a pair is an option for the player. I was taking that option with my jacks. The dealer and the others at the table all said I shouldn't split my jacks. Well, that was very helpful, but I said I'd read that was the best play and wanted to make it. They got stronger in their opinion, saying I was wrong and I should never split jacks. I didn't like being pushed, and it was my game, and I split my jacks. What should they care? That changed the whole vibe of the table. Two of the four other players got up and just stood over it, watching and grumbling about how stupid I was and how I'd ruined the table with my dumb play. They were pissed. It turns out they, and many players, believe there's a whole flow to a dealer's shoe full of cards and that everyone's destiny at the table is set, but only if everyone plays the optimal rules. By making a wrong play, I had put a bad juju on the whole flow of the cards. Thinking they were assholes, we carried on. But wow, did our luck change. We lost every single hand after that, and very quickly ran out of the money we'd allocated for gambling. Being a bit pissed ourselves, we went to the floor manager of the casino. We complained about the behavior of the other players. She listened sympathetically and then asked us what we'd done. I said I'd split my jacks. She winced and shook her head and said, "That's pretty bad." Lesson learned, but on leaving, we still had one $10 chip and were passing a roulette table. I asked Nancy if she wanted to play it on two, our number. Why not? It hit, and we made $350.